Hazel Ward.
Just on what you raised, Adrian, about this rational choice or the lack of the grasping of that in any theory, including Hegelianism, I think that's too mechanical and academic a way of looking at real revolutions. There is no blueprint, and there never will be a blueprint in any theory, because all revolutions are different, they're extremely complicated, we can never know the future. So if workers are winning reforms, of course there's no way in which even the person who has absorbed the greatest amount of dialectical theory can grasp at what point quantity is going to change into quality and the bourgeois state goes on the offensive. But the best supplement we have for an all-seeing, all-knowing eye, if you like, is a revolutionary party. And this goes into Natalie's question as well, which Tim mainly addressed, so I won't really dwell upon. But the reason we need philosophy, yes, it's linked to the party. Basically, I mean, Marx, there's a brilliant quote from Marx where he says that the workers' revolution is a much less, if you like, glamorous revolution than bourgeois revolutions. They're much more exacting. You know, bourgeois revolutions are like flashes in the pan, and you get these great individuals, these heroic individuals that appear and then disappear. And the reason for that is because the bourgeoisie, as I sort of said at the beginning, is a class that can bribe its way into power. That already before it's there, it doesn't really need a party as such, and it doesn't need a particularly clear theory. And that's really what a party is. A workers' party, a genuine Marxist party, is a theory, if you like, a revolutionary theory, but obviously organised in the form of a party, so that it can intervene in processes and, as you say, suggest to the workers, at this point we need to do this. And obviously the more right they are, the more they are proven right in history, and the bigger their voice is, the more they will begin to win people to their side. You know, this is something that the bourgeoisie doesn't really need as much. They can muddle their way to power. They already have influential individuals, and they're a competitive class, so it doesn't matter so much if one of them becomes corrupted by the old system. In fact, the bourgeois revolution quite likes it if they can make a compromise with the old system, hence the fact that we still have a feudalistic kind of monarchy in Britain. They never had a perfect bourgeois revolution, but a workers' revolution is a much cleaner break. It's about actually liberating humanity as a whole, and the working class is interested in that, in the sense that workers don't exploit other people. Workers don't benefit from, you know, from employing others, if you like, and exploiting them. So the working class coming to power really means the beginning of a process in history whereby humanity begins to actually deal with its problems, begins to meet humanity's needs directly. And I think, therefore, a theory which can take into account the whole process and not just muddle through it and can understand history really scientifically is therefore a coherent philosophy that is absolutely essential. And I think, as Tim has pointed out, that concessions to, you know, deceits, concessions to prejudice, basically, you know, lies in history by certain parties, for the people who think that the working class can be brought to power more easily by distortions and deceits, basically, are wrong. It does not work. You can't trick history, so to speak. You know, if you want to really change society and give the mass of people real power, give them the say over how society is run, which is what socialism is about, you have to tell them the truth. And to really grasp the truth, I think we need a pretty good philosophy. But I think all of your points about the role of philosophy in bourgeois society are correct. It is somewhat of a luxury, and it is removed from the real problems of people, and has, yeah, a very abstract and quite useless character very often. I won't deal with Jabran's points because I think they were kind of dealt with by others. What were the other points? Basically, two other points I want to touch upon, which will also go into the criticism of Marxist criticism of Hegel, which I wanted to finish with. This question of Glauber, I think it was, asked about the thing in itself. What that's replaced with. Well, Hegel said the thing in itself is a non-entity. It doesn't really exist. When we experience something, we experience, first of all, appearance. You don't experience the essence of a thing. You experience a fleeting moment of its existence. And that has led, again, idealists to think that we never can know the essence of a thing, hence this thing in itself. And you see this today in science as well. There's the idea that if you discover that by observing something, you also change what is observed, it's assumed that you don't know the thing because you've distorted it with yourself. You've added you into the equation and you want to know the thing in itself. But that's actually nonsense, because it's the way things really are, the essence of things, is precisely the way that they change in interaction with other objects. And you yourself are an object. So that the way something behaves when you study it, when you move it around, etc., is precisely in accordance with its nature. But of course, in the first phases of that, it is merely appearance. It's one-sided. So when we really want to know something, as Hegel explained, we need to know all of the sides of it. So it's not sufficient to do one experiment, which may be a distortion, but to do many experiments in many different ways. And thereby you get closer and closer to knowing the thing in itself. I suppose there's never absolute perfect knowledge of anything. That doesn't lead to, should not lead to the conclusion that there is some mystical essence of something which is always missing. Which, as Hegel pointed out, is devoid of content. Anything which really exists in something must be discoverable, because if it exists in the universe, it means it exists in relation to ourselves, because we exist in the universe and we must be composed of the same elements. We can therefore experience all sides of things and get to know the full picture of things. And after that, there's really nothing left. There's nothing to say about this thing in itself, and it ends up being quite a useless concept. What was the other point? Did Hegel think there were tendencies in human thinking? And this, I think, goes into the problem of Hegel. The problem of Hegel's idealism. Hegel did think that there were tendencies in human thought, that it wasn't just a sort of something a priori, if you like, that human thought develops in history. And it's the interaction between humanity and the world around us. And particularly, he emphasised the role of labour, actually before Marx. Most people don't know this, but Hegel developed the idea of labour as essential in creating knowledge. That it's the way in which we labour, the way in which we change the world around us, that we actually discover its essence. And obviously Marxists really agree with that. And therefore the tendencies in human thought do reflect the real world. And it's, again, that's not just because we change the world, that doesn't mean that we're distorting it and that we never know the world. It's true we are selfish creatures. We always are interested in knowing the parts of the world that are useful to us. But actually, it's precisely because of that that we do discover how the world really is, because it actually is helpful. And it's much better if our knowledge accords with reality. It's much more useful to us as selfish beings, as parts of the universe, if you like. We have to know the rest of the universe as it really is. So we begin to approximate the way things really are. And so this goes on to Marx's criticism of Hegel, of his inconsistency. The rational kernel, as Marx said, of his thoughts was really materialism. And Hegel describes quite well, first of all, as I said, that the laws of the universe don't exist as such. They never exist in pure form. They're immanent in the world. In other words, they are principles of existence that don't exist outside of concrete things, but they are the relationships between concrete things. And in doing that, he also criticised, quite rightly, religious people, even though he was himself religious, who treated God as if he were a particular entity standing outside of the universe. You know, a man, a personified, you know, just a really big man, basically, a very powerful man. And this actually loses the essence of a general or a universal, which God is supposed to be. He is the universe, apparently. Because, and he gave a nice example, that if you ask for fruit, you can never actually be given a fruit as such. You can only be given a particular apple, a particular pear, etc. And again, fruit as such does not exist. It's a generalisation of real relationships that do exist between particular fruits, if you like. But it doesn't exist in itself. There's no such thing as fruit in general. And Marx elaborated on that point and said, well, if that's the case, which it clearly is, it adds nothing to say that this is all really just a manifestation of some idea, which Hegel said. So Hegel was inconsistent. On the one hand, he said there can be no God. As soon as God is a concrete individual that sort of gives birth to things, then he ceases to be God, if you like. He ceases to be the overall process and is merely a particular, merely one thing in the universe. And we can also add to that, why on earth, if the source of all the laws of the universe is not the immanent within matter itself, is not just the way matter must behave, but is given to the universe by God, by God's act of creation, if you like, if that's the case, then why on earth does God make the world in this way and not another? What causes God to have these laws, if you like, that he imposes onto the world? It's a complete mystery, and Engels points that out about Hegel, that for all of his endless repetition, that in reality all of these laws and everything and the whole history of development is really just the concretization of some absolute idea, which is what Hegel thought. The realization of the principles, if you like, that these principles sort of somehow exist before reality, which is just a poor reflection of them. And this is his inconsistency. And Engels pointed out that actually he says nothing about the absolute idea. There is no absolute idea. It can't even exist. It doesn't mean anything. You can never actually, and this goes back to Hegel's own point, that there's no such thing as this I, this individual in abstraction. All consciousness is consciousness of things. You can never actually describe an ideal existence. So a Christian has a great deal of trouble describing God. And as soon as they do, it falls into contradictions because they're immediately describing basically just a powerful human being. And then they want to say, well, it's not that. It's not that. It's all over the universe. It's everywhere. It's not a person at all. But then how do you describe that? How do you give it any sensibility? The only way to do it is obviously to describe some particular thing, which they don't want to say is the case. So Marx grasped, actually, that the task started by Hegel to show that the tendencies in human thinking are not finished, they're not sort of, you know, a priori, they're not there, locked in the head, but they're the crystallization of human experience and human labor in the real world. But then Marx said that the real way, therefore, to solve this problem of knowledge, of how we have knowledge, what determines our knowledge, what knowledge is correct, is in practice. And therefore, the real sort of cause of ideas is not to be found in just the study of our heads, in the study of schemas of thought, but is in history, is in the real process of changing the world, which is what history really is. Really, history, Marx explained the real mechanism of these things, which Hegel failed to do. And the real mechanism of the development of thought is actually the development of the productive forces, is the development of technology, basically, that allows us to change the world. The development of, you know, new machines that mean that we now have different relations towards one another. When you have factories, obviously, you have different relations between people than when you have nomads or settled agriculture. And then, therefore, the ideas change with this. But we also know that this leads to incomplete ideas. The ideas we have, if you like, at the moment that are predominant are the ideas of the ruling class. And their interests are a distortion. They do distort reality because they're one-sided, because they're not the interests of the whole of humanity, but the interests of one particular segment of it who exploits everyone else. So the ideas that we have to hand around us that we usually use to understand society, I'm not really talking about us because, you know, we're Marxists, we have different ideas, but the idea that most people have are actually in contradiction with reality, you know, and don't really explain anything. So this idea we all live in a dog-eat-dog world and humanity must be like that and that's the world, way the world runs, that's never really subjected to analysis, it's just assumed to be true. And then we have this other contradiction between the knowledge that we have on the one hand about how society works, which is produced in study after study showing that greater inequality is bad for health, is bad for humanity, and would be much better if we had investment in useful things that meant we lived better and were healthier and better education, full employment, that would be better. And yet despite that, the sort of political theories which are predominant are in total contradiction with that. They basically say that the free market is good, the free market is good, the free market is good, and everything else we won't even touch upon. And they don't even think that they have to bring the two in relation. They don't even seem to think that they have to justify the endless inequality, the endless poverty. And so to achieve the full realization of human knowledge, if you like, although there's never a full realization in the sense there's never an end point, there's never a finished point when history ends, but to really bring our ideas back into line with reality and with real experience requires not just a revolution in thought, but a revolution in society, a social revolution, when actually the people who have the same interests as the rest of humanity, in other words, the working class, who don't have an interest in exploiting anyone. They set the tone. They, you know, run the newspapers. They run the TV shows, and they control the universities and the funding and what investment goes where and what it, how that is linked to achieving what humanity needs. And when we have that, we will, I think, have actually much more consistent ideas, a much better reflection of reality, and not just for the preserve of the rich either. So it's the real fight for materialist ideas, if you like, is, I think, the fight for socialism. And I would encourage everyone to hold that in mind when they go to these meetings, when they discuss these things.